title is Progressivism, Philanthropy, and Property Rights. Bill tied together progressivism and philanthropy. Tom Bray will tie together philanthropy and property rights. Tom has writes a twice-a-week column on political, economic, and social issues for the Detroit News, where he served as editorial page writer from 1983 to May 2000. His columns are frequently reprinted in the New York Sun, the Washington Times, and the Wall Street Journal, and the National Interest. Under his leadership, the Detroit News helped to lead award-winning fights in Michigan for, now listen carefully, lower taxes, welfare reform, environmental balance, and educational choice, very close to the themes of the ownership society that we have been talking about. Tom graduated from Princeton. He's also a trustee of the Earhart Foundation, and also is a very closely associated with the Property and Environment Research Center, or PERC, of Bozeman, Montana. Whenever you meet a person who's very strong on the environment and ecology, if you want to find out if they know anything at all, ask them if they know anything about PERC. Unfortunately, invariably, no, they don't, but you've got a good source of materials that you can feed them, and you can find their materials on the web. Because there are people who take the environment seriously, take environmental issues seriously, but also try to deal with it within the context of property rights and understanding the role of private property in alleviating our environmental difficulties. Most recently, Tom is the author of Soaring High, New Strategies for Environmental Giving, published by the Philanthropy Roundtable in 2005. And that book just came out, I think, this year, didn't it, Tom? So, Tom, I'll let you have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. With your permission, may I speak from one of the previous speakers? I had to hold it up like this. I would too, so if I sit here, I can be a little closer to my notes and see them a little more easily. Thanks for referring to that book. I have some copies, as it happens. There's some out on the table outside, and I have a few right here if anybody would like to get one. I should emphasize the journalistic nature of my of both this and what I'm going to say here today for two reasons. One, I am a journalist. I'm not an expert in this subject, but I'm always reminded when I'm asked to speak at these functions that I usually follow people who actually know what they're talking about. Lord Northcliffe once defined a journalist as somebody whose job it was to explain to others what he himself didn't understand. So I'll try to do that today. When we're talking about progressivism, philanthropy, and property rights, and my focus really is the environment, I think it's important to understand that by the time the progressive movement came along, or at least received its name, conservation already was a formidable force in the United States. As a historian at Ohio University, John Reiger, points out that by the late 1800s, there were some 300 sportsmen's clubs, 34 fishing clubs, and numerous publications that had sprung up, all with the mission of conserving species and habitat that hunters could literally see were diminishing. I mean, they knew what they were talking about. They could see that there had been diminishing populations of certain game birds and so on, and they wanted to conserve them. A practical link between conservation and what they enjoyed doing in their private lives. And they did this chiefly by protecting habitat and promulgating ethics of hunting that emphasized the need to build up and conserve stocks of game animals on private property. Teddy Roosevelt was a founding member of one such group, the Boone and Crockett Society, which still exists today, by the way. The Sierra Club, of course, was founded in 1892 in part to protect the recreational interests of San Francisco area hikers and nature lovers. And the Audubon Society, founded in 1887 to protest the use of bird feathers in women's hats, which was a great fashion trend of the time. And the Audubon Society is a very interesting history. It established a chain of privately owned wildlife and forest sanctuaries And they paid for personnel to patrol these sanctuaries and keep the poachers out and otherwise enforce whatever rules they wanted to have for the property they owned. And they were very effective at it, according to most accounts. R.J. Smith at Competitive Enterprise Institute has looked fairly carefully at this history. And he notes that it was in the course of amassing these private preserves that the Ottoman Society, in one of those examples of unintended consequences, actually pushed President Roosevelt into essentially nationalizing the conservationist ideal. And this happened because the Audubon Society for years had been lobbying to establish a sanctuary that it would run and own on, or at least run, on Pelican Island, which is a spit of land just off the east coast of Florida that happened to belong to the federal government. The island was rich in bird life, particularly brown pelicans and snowy egrets and other showy birds that made ideal suppliers of feathers for women's millinery. But poaching on the island was rapidly depleting the wildlife, and the government, naturally, was doing nothing about it. So Ottoman asked the government to turn the island over to its care. Nothing doing, came the response. But Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, was enthusiastic about the notion of having the government itself establish a wildlife refuge. So Pelican Island became the first of the national wildlife refuges, an archipelago now consisting of 546 national wildlife preserves covering 95 million acres, which is nearly 40 times the size of Yellowstone National Park. So what does the modern-day Ottoman Society make of this? Well, of course, it now claims credit for launching the progressive era in environmental policy and avidly supports placing even more land into the hands of government. But I was reading an Ottoman Society magazine recently and was somewhat startled to learn. I wondered what the Ottoman Society now made of it's the 100th anniversary of the National Wildlife Sanctuaries. And Ottoman was in this article in its own magazine, was complaining that 200 of the 546 preserves don't have on-site staff, and that most of the rest were drastically underfunded. Hello? Nevertheless, the progressive variant of the conservationist impulse continues to have great political power. President Clinton managed to federalize a record amount of land. Most of the environmental establishment is now either headquartered in or has a major presence in Washington, all the better to make sure that the collectivist approach to environmental issues continues unchallenged. And not so coincidentally that these organizations will get their share of the federal environmental dollar. The environmental movement also has powerful allies in the media. Most of my colleagues remain firmly entrenched in the environmental camp, quick to amplify the conventional wisdom that any failure to fatten government's environmental budget is evidence of a plot by right-wing fanatics in the corporate world to despoil Mother Nature. The mainline churches and even now the evangelicals are being enlisted on the side of the environmental gospel, that man has sinned against God's creation and thus must offer penance in the form of more taxes and more purchases of government land. And most of the philanthropic world's money continues to underwrite the progressive agenda when it comes to the environment. Only 2 weeks ago, the creme de la creme of the philanthropic world, Bradley Foundation, I think, excluded, attended the annual retreat of something called the Environmental Grantmakers Association. This was established in 1987 by the Rockefeller Family Fund. They meet to discuss the environmental movement and the broader, and this is the quote from their program, the broader progressive political agenda. Now we're talking about 250 foundations, including most of the heavyweights, Ford, Carnegie, Pew, Hewlett, and so on. They control billions in assets. I hardly need to tell this group just how blinkered and politically correct this world has become. Here is how their program for the recent conclave instructed its participants. Quote, "This retreat should demonstrate the values we hold as environmental grantmakers by encouraging shared transportation, printing with recycled non-toxic materials, serving sustainable foods." Philadelphia Society knows better than to try that one. "Using alternative energy sources and staying mindful of our impact on the planet." And then it was on to the opening session of the retreat titled Diversity Workshop for Funders. Exactly what that has to do with the environment, I'm not too sure. And in any case, that diversity included one, count him one, identifiable libertarian conservative, Jerry Taylor of the Cato Institute. And the agenda for this 2.5-day meeting was 16 pages long. Thank goodness for this. Fred Smith of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, in a talk to the Mont Pelerin Society a few years back, spelled out what he saw as, quote, "the environmental threat to classical liberal values." As he put it, quote, "The forces that once marched under the banner of economic progressivism have regrouped under a new environmental banner. Economic central planning is not in vogue, but environmental central planning has taken its place." As Fred sees it, the progressive movement of the early 20th century cut short a budding environmental ethic that, if it had been allowed to play out, would have succeeded by now in devising all sorts of free market, common law, local solutions to questions of balancing man and nature, and that it would have done so faster and more sustainably, to borrow a favorite environmental word, than a command and control approach. The forces mustered on behalf of free market environmentalism, community environmentalism, and other forms of conservative and libertarian environmental strategies seem meager indeed. The Sacramento Bee did an excellent series several years ago, an unusual series, concluding that the 100 biggest environmental organizations in this country dispose of $3.5 billion annually. I doubt that free market environmentalists command much more than $5 to $10 million. Yes, environmentalists frequently assert that this doesn't include corporate lobbying and propaganda, but most of that is spent to further particular corporate interests, not to fund a principled defense of markets and political freedom. But I would nonetheless argue that there are some reasons for optimism. One of them is precisely that the modern environmentalists are so pessimistic these days. In order to pump up contributions, as the Sacramento Bee noted, they are forced to pump out scare stories. And most of these are proving to be either fictitious or absurdly exaggerated. Not for nothing does 42% of the American public, according to one recent poll, equate the environmental movement with extremism, even as virtually all Americans continue to consider themselves environmentalists. The environmental movement, as currently defined, is headed for a severe credibility crisis. And some of them know it. You've all read about the debate within the environmental community touched off by the publication of an essay by a pair of California environmentalists proclaiming the death of environmentalism. What they meant, of course, was that their form of environmentalism, public support for greater and greater government regulation of the economy, is dying, or at least fading in importance. Meanwhile, organizations such as PERC, the Property and Environment Research Center, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the Sand County Foundation here in Wisconsin, Pacific Research Institute, the Heartland Institute, and many others are developing much more optimistic frameworks for thinking about the environment and man's place in it. Americans like optimism. This is a movement headed into the political mainstream. In this book that I did for the Philanthropy Roundtable, I also tell the story of a new generation of environmentally conscious donors, prominently including the Bradley Foundation, who are finding creative new ways to make environmental progress. Or perhaps I should say creative old ways, since many of them mimic the private, highly localized environmental efforts that were in bloom before they were swamped by progressivism, and much later, the flood of federal law and litigation that characterized the last third of the 20th century. At the heart of this new thinking, of this new environmentalism, is the understanding that man is here to stay, that technology can be the friend of the environment, that local action tends to get better results than federally mandated command and control, and that economic and political freedom is indispensable in reconciling human endeavor and Mother Nature. There will always be some role for government, but the returns are rapidly diminishing. An energetic private sector is the key to dealing with the multiplicity of problems and felt needs of our increasingly affluent society. I make that point because as society's wealth increases, demand for environmental amenities also increases. This is taken in some quarters to mean that we need more and more government spending. In fact, it should make it possible to attract more private investment for good environmental ideas, rather than rely on the fatal conceits that go with the environmentalism now in vogue. Philanthropy can show the way for these market solutions, rather than just showing the way for government solutions. Practical results, as opposed as you were talking about earlier, Bill. The philanthropy can do this if it wants to. And Aldo Leopold, who is often used by environmentalists, used and abused by environmentalists, had some interesting things to say in this regard. One of which, a quote that I love to repeat, he said, "Wild things didn't acquire much value until technology assured us of a good breakfast." Wild things didn't acquire much value. Well, of course, when wild things do acquire value, people have an interest, find ways to develop property rights in them, and have incentives to conserve them. Once the environment ceases to be thought of as a charity, then it will be much safer. Even many environmental organizations, such as Environmental Defense, formerly Environmental Defense Fund, are beginning to acknowledge the power of the old arguments that private property tends to be better cared for than the commons. One must not be deluded that their willingness to entertain market-based Tocquevillian emphasis on community responses. But when Fred Krupp of Environmental Defense makes the point that with 40% of the land of our country's land already in government hands, it's hard to see where the wealth can be generated for yet more government programs, it's clear that we're making some progress. Of course, there's the mother of all environmental scares, global warming. It's a very handy device for arguing for another great leap forward in government, indeed world government. But the failure of the Kyoto Treaty to gain much traction suggests that the public is still pretty skeptical, having observed so much hype on other problems that didn't turn out to be really serious problems. Americans don't seem too interested either in Al Gore's call for a, quote, wrenching transformation of civilization. And I think we're seeing some other wake-up calls, including the lack of refinery capacity in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Refinery capacity, environmentalism has had a lot to do with the lack of refinery capacity. It's far too soon to declare victory for the environmental optimists, and one must be careful in pointing out the defects of command and control, not to denigrate the environmental impulses of the public. There is plenty of ancient authority for the need to act as good stewards of creation. But it's already clear that environmental pessimism has passed its peak, and we might take some hope in that regard from the experience with welfare reform. Disaster did not strike when we reformed welfare, and I suspect the public would be perfectly prepared to believe that disaster would not strike if we reformed our environmental laws.
The object, after all, should be to improve the environment, not simply get rid of the laws or to say that the environment's fine and we don't need to worry about it any longer. The problem is to get the human incentives right so that it lines up with the private property interests and we unleash the energies of countless people, countless Americans, to deal with environmental problems, each of which is so particular to particular areas that Washington is totally ineffective in dealing with them. The old progressive model was put on the defensive by the failure of socialism and the highly successful deregulation, tax-cutting, and entrepreneurial model of the Reagan movement. Our latter-day green progressives, meanwhile, have been placed on the defensive by their own inflated rhetoric of the dangers we face and the rise of a new paradigm, free market environmentalism. In short, I have some confidence, though hardly 100% surety, that the intellectual initiative is passing to a new generation. Thank you very much. Thank you.